Next case is 2011-1002, Atlantic Research v. Troy. Whenever you're ready.
Your Honor, I think this is, I'll be pretty brief here. On this issue of invalidity, the issue goes to what does the word support mean? Now, we proposed it means bear weight or hold up. The judge reads it and adds completely or wholly, or partially or completely, excuse me. Now, we have
Let me ask you something. You're now saying that you completely agree that the spec doesn't disclose a one-point attachment. Is that right?
Right.
Right. Now, obviously, that's inconsistent with what you argued below when you were citing expert testimony to the contrary, correct?
No.
In the response to their motion for summary judgment, you have pages of testimony that you cite from your expert saying that it clearly discloses a one-point attachment.
The patent, I think it's undisputed at this trial, which was a trade secret trial, that the patent did not disclose.
All right. We've got patent issues. We've got trade secret issues.
Right.
Let's talk about the patent issues.
Okay.
In your patent case, you argued below in response to the summary judgment motion. I can pull it out if you want. You cite page after page of expert testimony about how you argued that it disclosed a one-point attachment. And you're now admitting in your brief here that it doesn't.
That's correct.
So do you now agree that you couldn't establish infringement under your patent since the allegedly infringing device, I understood, has a one-point attachment and there's no dispute over that?
Do I agree that I cannot establish infringement?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
And obviously you want to know why.
Yes.
Right. And that's the difference between trade secrets and or patents. If for example, we take the district court's claim construction as it exists today, and she construed the claim to say that support means, et cetera, hold up partially or completely, all right? That patent's valid. Why is that valid? Because in the patent, it's undisputed that there is a disclosure of partially supporting it. It's undisputed if you apply the word or. My appeal here is that she applied, when she actually applied the claim, and Judge Saris is a very good judge. I've tried many cases in front of him. But she applied the claim with the and, reading into the claim the fact that there has the completely
right.
Limitation.
Maybe part of the problem is that you were doing the same thing to her that you're doing to us, which is you're arguing out of both sides of your mouth. So you argued below that it did show a one-point attachment, and you're arguing here that it does not. So what I'm trying to understand is the relevance. Are you trying to save your patent from an invalidity but are agreeing that you can't establish infringement on a one-point attachment?
I'm trying to save the patent from validity because I believe that her claim construction and application of that claim construction saying that my patent's indefinite / best mode problem is fundamental error because she didn't even apply her own claim construction.
Okay.
She applied, if you applied her claim construction, there is no basis for that summary judgment motion. Now, I know what you're getting at, and first of all, at the trade secret trial, the position was that it was not disclosed in the patent. That's that. I understand where you're coming from vis-a-vis the summary judgment, which was alternatively pled and argued. It was on that issue. But The point is, now the question you're really asking me is, okay, the patent is held valid, that the patent is now reversed, a decision, it goes back, and now the question is there an infringement? That's what you're asking me. And you're asking me, then, how can it be? Now, I figured that was going to be the question of the day, so to speak. First of all, we haven't got there. I'm only here to get the patent held valid. But secondly, if we do get there, single attachment can be an infringement. And let me tell you exactly why. Because the question is, what's the invention? Now, analogies, as we all know, can bite you. And I'm going to give it a try, and if it bites me, so be it. But let's assume we have an airplane. Orville Wright invents the airplane. Before him, all we have is birds. He then claims a machine for flying, period. On the way to the patent office, he thinks about a jet engine. And he invents a jet engine. He doesn't disclose the jet engine in the patent. Okay? He keeps the jet engine as a trade secret. Let's assume he did that. Later on, someone puts a jet engine on a plane. Can he sue him? Absolutely. Why? Because his invention is a flying machine. It's not a flying machine with a jet engine that can maneuver around.
I'm not sure I appreciate or understand the analogy, but bringing it back to our case, if the claim here, you're acknowledging that the claim here covers just a single attachment, right? That's your position, because how else could you go for infringement unless it was the single attachment, correct?
The claim as written would. Just read it, would. Sure.
And as I understand, what happened below was that the district court said you haven't supplied a sufficient written description in the specification to cover a single attachment. Do you disagree with that? Is there something in the specification that would adequately describe the single attachment?
No.
There's not.
I agree wholly with the judge's conclusion that the specification does not disclose supporting the handguard with solely or completely with a barrel nut. Wholly. But if you look at her claim construction, this is hers. She says partially or one or the other. So therefore, the question, you don't have to disclose every embodiment in the world to have an infringement. That's not a requirement.
Can I ask one more question? How do you differentiate between claim 11 and claim 31? They were both added in the re-exam and their respective dependent claims. What's the distinction?
That's a good question. I haven't thought of it. I thought of 11. I haven't really given any thought. I mean, if there's something in 11 that they were both, you are right, Your Honor, both were added in re-examination, which, by the way, when we talk about this, that's not an inconsequential issue or thought, because this claim was broadened in re-examination.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the only declaration says you were going to go in because you thought that claims 1 through 6 were too narrow, and all of a sudden claims 1 through 6 remain exactly as they were, and you rewrite claims 11 and 31, or an add 31. So
That's how they do it.
It's unclear from the prosecution history why the examiner allowed this.
Because the examiner appreciated that the claims as granted were narrower than in fact what the patent attorney, what the inventor.
So what is it you were
but
trying?
But you don't have to get rid of the first
claims. What were you
claims.
Trying to add? If you weren't trying to add a one-point attachment, what were you trying to add in re-exam?
What they were trying to add is had to do with the beefing up of the yoke. That's what they were trying. They were trying to focus the invention on the yoke as opposed to not. And by the way, let me just end with this so that you can, if you can grab my airplane analogy, is arms is the first one ever to support a hand guard with a barrel nut, period. Now, not solely, partially, or whatever. He's the first. He's the overwrite, so to speak, in this business, so to speak, in that analogy. So if that makes any sense to you. But you can indeed have trade secrets, and there's treaties written on this, trade secrets and patents, and they can all exist. And I think the issue here, that's going to be an issue, by the way, for Judge Saris after this, because I think the sole issue before this court is her claim construction correct? And on its face, it's absolutely incorrect. It's applied incorrectly. And if it's correct, then the patent is not invalid vis-a-vis written description because the R is there and it's undisputed that indeed there is support in the patent for partially holding it up. No question about that. That's undisputed by everybody. So I would ask that A, if you do adopt her construction, then you must submit respectfully that you must vacate her summary judgment motion of invalidity, send it back, and then we will have this treaties discussion vis-a-vis the interplay between trade secrets, patents, and infringement. But that's not before this court, not even close on this appeal here.
You're into your rebuttal time. You want to save the remainder?
No, I'm going to have to say something on the, because this is a cross appeal. So
yes, so you've got 3 minutes, just under 3 minutes remaining. And why don't we hear from the other side?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Now, you all have split your time as well.
Yes, we have, Your Honor.
So you've allotted. Are you Mr. McNulty or Mr. LaFlaca?
I am Mr. McNulty, and I'm intending to speak on the patent issues. And Mr.
And
LaFlaca,
you've got 4 minutes? Okay. So why don't you address Mr. Hayes's argument with respect to the claim construction and how the claim construction had an or there so it could cover either one that it ought to be okay under written description.
The one thing Mr. Hayes does not do is indicate how his proposed construction would result in any difference in scope from the construction that the court arrived at. The court made clear, the district court, excuse me, made clear that it was applying the plain meaning that ARMS sought. And they were employing the full meaning of support. It could be partial, it could be complete. That's the scope of support.
Yeah, but she said either or in her construction that you did not appeal. So the question is there a problem with the fact that she interpreted her own construction to require complete support?
No, it's bedrock patent law that the specification to meet the written description requirement must demonstrate that the inventor was in possession of the full scope of the claims at issue. Mr. Hayes, I believe, acknowledged that under ARM's proposed interpretation, the full scope would include single point attachment. Therefore, the specification must demonstrate that the inventor was in possession of single point attachment as a
device. So you're saying even though her claim construction was in the or, that both sides of that or had to be met by the specification, had to be covered by the specification?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I can give you some case law on that effect. It was in our summary judgment brief, but I don't know that it made it into our appeal brief. But the ICU medical case, it's 558 F3D 1368. The Chiron Corp case, 363 F3D 1247, and the Liebel-Flarsheim, I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly, case, 481 F3D 1371. In each of these cases, the court determined that the full scope of the claims must be supported by the specification. I'm trying not to use the word support in the two different contexts here. There must be written description in the specification of the full scope of the claims. In
isn't this somewhat backward, though, from the way we often approach this? I mean, couldn't you argue that, as you did below, that the claim construction actually should only show partial support because the specification doesn't show complete support with a one-point attachment?
Well, the problem with that is the claim language itself is not ambiguous. We were actually trying to get the receiver sleeve limitation read into the upper handguard part, which would have been a second point of attachment.
We don't need to find that the claim language is ambiguous in order to look at the rest of the specification. That's a pretty basic principle. So normally the court should not construe a claim to assert an invention that's not disclosed anywhere in the specification, right?
Actually, under the Phillips v. AWH Corp case, 415 F3D 1303, and the particular language is at 1327-8, this court specifically identified that the duty to preserve claims, or the doctrine of preserving claims to, construing claims to preserve the validity, is only applicable in cases which, after applying all the available tools of claim construction, the claim is still ambiguous. Where the claim term at issue is not ambiguous, the doctrine of construing claims to preserve their validity has no applicability.
That's not the doctrine I'm talking about. I'm talking about the doctrine that says you got to look at the specification to see what the invention is.
Okay,
I do
understand.
Is that irrelevant to the claim construction analysis?
That is not irrelevant, but if you look to the specification, the term support is used to refer to both partial and complete support. So in terms of construing the word support, the specification itself identifies the sleeve as self-supported by connection to the rear portion, underside to the receiver top. They're referring to complete support there. The background, referring to the prior art, talks about the requirement that gun barrels be extra heavy to support the added weight attached by means of collars. They're referring to complete support of these collars and the things that are attached to them. In the summary itself, where arms intended for support to be limited, they used a limiting term. They refer to additional support that may be provided by the addition of a special yoke. They recognized the need to put in a term to modify support so that it was not complete support. They did not do so in the claims. And actually, to address your question to Mr. Hayes, the distinction between Claim 11 and Claims 31 to 36 is that Claim 11 specifically recites the receiver sleeve. Claims 31 to 36 do not.
I think you've exhausted your portion of the time. Why don't we turn to your colleague, Mr. LaPlaca? Is it your job to do the cross-appeal here?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Okay. May it please the Court. The central issue on the trade side, secret side of the case is whether the district court erred in finding in her state court rulings that ARMS created a handguard, a single-point attachment handguard, on January 20, 1999, in other words, one that attached only to the barrel, not to the weapon for support. And we claim that she did err because she ruled before trial that if the only trade secrets were clamping to the barrel nut, ARMS loses. And she made that ruling on the specific representation of ARMS 3 weeks before trial.
Yeah, but if you look at the entire context of her discussion, what she said was, if the only thing you're claiming is a trade secret is disclosed in the 245, then you lose.
That's right.
So
that's right.
You take a few sentences out of context and try to make that a broader statement, but all she was talking about was the 245, not the later patent, not the reissue.
That's right. But what she's saying is that the if your trade secret is just the clamping mechanism, then that's not a trade secret. You've got to give me the more. And then they said, well, the more is the machining techniques. The more is how to attach. Attachments to it and different things such as that. She said, that's what I'll be looking for at the actual trial. So consistent with that ruling, at trial, ARMS introduced only evidence of a two-point attachment handguard. The two witnesses were Mr. Swan and Sergeant Major Barreras, and they each gave physical demonstrations of the handguard and recite at length their testimony in our briefs. And we also gave the court the videotape testimony of Sergeant Major Barreras, where he says the receiver sleeve is an integral part of the handguard of the 1999 prototype, which was developed in the basement on January 20, 1999.
But Swan's testimony specifically talks about attaching only to the barrel nut that would allow a complete support, free float support by single point attachment. So his testimony didn't just disclose a 2.0 test.
He said, this is what I have. But he didn't show that to the jury. Because the only evidence he showed to the jury is the receiver is an integral part of the 1999 prototype. And he gave a demonstration of that. He actually got off the seat and he showed how the receiver sleeve goes over the top of the handguard.
But you're really just asking us to disagree with the jury here. I mean, the jury had the 245. The judge told them that if the only thing that was that he didn't disclose was in the 245, he loses. And the jury still found in his favor. So,
well, I'm not asking to disagree with what the jury did. I'm asking to disagree with what the judge did. We think the judge should have never allowed that to go to the jury because, one, she ruled that the attaching the clamp to the barrel nut is not a trade secret. So then they introduced a two-point attachment. And then all those other things, the more, which were the process how to manufacture the machine, all that laundry list of things. They didn't introduce any evidence of them that they were actual trade secrets, and then they never linked them to anything that Troy had done. They had no evidence of the manufacturing of arms and of Troy. No evidence of that whatsoever.
Before your time runs out, let me turn your attention to the mistrial allegations here. I mean, with respect to jury taint, as the district court judge pointed out, you failed to object in any way, shape, or form to her plan on how to proceed, not to timing, not to substance, not to procedure. Why isn't that a sufficient degree of waiver so that you can't come back here now and argue taint?
Do you mean on the Allen charge?
No, on the other aspect.
On the clamp?
Yes.
Well, she didn't take any proactive measures during trial. In fact, she said on the record, I'm not going to do this until after the jury returns. And then after the jury returned, then we found out that the clamp was in the jury room, not that day, but the actual day before.
So why didn't you make a record? Why didn't you ask her to immediately call the jury in and make inquiry?
Well, we did. And she asked those kind of perfunctory questions in front of each other juror, which said, who brought in the clamp? It was juror number 5. Did you talk to the clamp? Yes, we did. Thank you very much. To all 12 jurors.
That was after the verdict.
That's right. That was after the verdict.
No, we're talking about before the verdict.
Well,
you were
aware
of this, and the judge announced how she planned to proceed, and there was no objection that I could find in the record with respect to how she planned to proceed.
Well, there was no instruction that could be given at that point. And she said, I'm not going to do anything until afterwards. That was her decision to make. I won't do anything until afterwards.
Well, isn't it your position here that she should have done something before?
Well, she should have found out beforehand.
Yeah, and so did you suggest that when she was saying, I'm not going to do anything till afterwards, did you say, no, Your Honor, we request that you do something now?
Well, we didn't know at that point that there was the clamp was in the jury room the day before. Had we known that, we would have asked for that, but we didn't know that at the time.
Well, neither did she, right? The only way to have known that would have called the jury in before the verdict, right?
But she had made this specific decision, which she told us on the record, I'm not going to do anything until after the jury verdict. And then she says afterwards, had you asked me, we would have done so. But I thought, well, you've already told us you're not going to do it until afterwards. That's your decision to make. And we did.
That's true of pretty much everything that goes on at the trial level, but it's still up to the parties to object to if they disagree with how the judge is planning to proceed, is it not?
Well, we think we had objected, at least on the Allen charge, we think we had adequately objected in that point, where
right.
She says she didn't think that we did object. But again, had we known the full scope of what the jury was thinking at that time, then we would have made an objection and said, Judge, it's been on the jury's mind for the past 2 days. So there's clearly jury taint here. So we've got a problem with this because there is clearly, I think, the jury taint.
But you're saying you just didn't discover that till after the verdict came.
That's right.
Around.
That's right. We couldn't have until after the verdict because we didn't find out that the jury had actually found out or said that the clamp was in the room the day before. So there's obviously a huge problem with this jury verdict. And because I didn't say objection, I want something done right now, I don't think excuses the fact that we've got a problem with the jury verdict.
What is the taint that you're talking about? The judge said there wasn't taint.
Well, how can you determine that there wasn't a taint on the record that the judge had? Clearly, it was on the juror's mind the day before because somebody had brought it in, they talked about it, and you can see from the jury notes.
We don't know if they talked about it.
I'm sorry?
How do we know if they talked about it?
Because in one of the jury notes, they said, a juror brought in the clamp, and I think they connected to the sympathy, and they made that objection because somebody had brought the clamp into the room. And clearly it was still on their minds the next day because they still talked about it the next day.
There's something in the record indicating that that was related to the sympathy? I didn't see that.
I've got to remember what the actual jury question looked like.
There were two different points that were being made. One is the clamps in the room, and they wanted to know if that was okay to bring outside things in. The other was that we think one of the jurors, not necessarily the clamp person, was basing their verdict or absence of a verdict on sympathy.
Right. I think that you can't know what the jury talked about, no doubt about that. But from the actual the question that they brought it into the room, and it was in the room they talked about it the second day, we certainly will never know that or what the specific discussion was. But we do know that the jurors had a hard time with that issue, and we do know that they talked about sympathy. Well, you can't connect sympathy to the actual discussion of the clamp. So we think that's a problem with the way the jury rendered the verdict. If there are no other questions, I'd like to reserve the time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think you've got a couple minutes left for rebuttal on the cross appeal.
I'll be brief, Your Honor. The trade secret, obviously a question of fact. The judge wrote a 19-page 93A decision detailing chapter and verse, and my brother's trying to retry a trade secret case all over again, and he's doing it with all due respect by misciting or quoting and cropping the record here and there, particularly on the Barreras testimony. He brought this as a motion to the district court afterwards, asking for a new trial. The district court on TA-36 addressed it specifically and pointed to where Barreras did corroborate that it was a single attachment, etc. And I'm not going to I think I waste my time trying to say, obviously there's more than sufficient support on the mass law to say this verdict. With respect to my brother's argument of Allen charges, clamps, damages, and all the rest, I think Judge Saris did a good job explaining in detail her rationale. And this clamp stuff, what she basically said is he never asked for a corrective instruction. It was a strategy under Massachusetts law. If you don't ask for a corrective instruction, and that's your strategy because maybe you don't want to upset the jury or whatever the status is. If you don't do it, you lose it, and that's mass law. With regard to my brother's going back, if I have just a few seconds,
Let me ask you about this clamp and the inquiry. I mean, the judge specifically asked if you all knew what the procedure was. You've tried cases, I take it, for years. You've never had a situation where there was an allegation of some improper item being brought into the jury room?
Have I had one? No, I haven't. But I mean,
Have you ever seen it happen before?
Oh, sure. But I mean, I've tried a lot of cases, criminal and patents, criminal first. But you have to, in Massachusetts, if you think there's something wrong, you have to ask the judge on the point to give a corrective instruction. If you don't, and the mass law, which is what we're talking about here, that's assumed.
Well, even in the criminal context, don't make the objection, then it is analyzed under a plain error analysis, and the First Circuit has said that the judge has a duty to inquire and to timely inquire.
The judge, I believe, give an instruction relative to this clamp. What the issue, what she ruled, and when this issue was brought up vis-a-vis a trial on the clamp, was that my brother has an affirmative obligation under Massachusetts law that if he thinks she did something wrong or wants a corrective instruction, to ask her for it. And if he doesn't, he waives it. And the reason he does it is because under Massachusetts law, it's assumed that that's a strategic move made by him, not so that he can now in an appellate court save it for later. It's either you do it or you don't. And we cited the law, and that's right on. And I think Judge Saris is right on that issue. And the only other question I would like to just briefly talk about is my brother's concept On this claim construction issue, I disagree with the citations to the law, and that for the reasons I explained in the brief. But we have to take the district court's claim construction as written. That's the issue. And the problem where we asked to go, if you go further and take out the word completely, so you took that out, all right, because she's adding it as an and instead of an or, the court found that there is no disclosure in this patent of supporting a handguard completely by a barrel nut. No question, no dispute.
You want to wrap up your argument?
Right.
The time is-
so you cannot take that. If there's no extrinsic evidence, you can't read it into a claim and then say, now that I read it in, the claim's invalid. That's the problem. Thanks, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. On the cross appeal, we'll give you an extra minute, so you'll get a couple minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
In light of the additional time.
On the clamp issue, we did argue that the court does have the duty to inquire. In fact, I've not tried a case before where that's ever happened before. We're standing around with the rules of civil procedure trying to figure out what
so
to
did
do.
You tell the did you tell the judge, no, you've got to bring the jury in now and inquire?
I didn't tell her that then, no.
And did you object to what she was doing? Did you ask for a curative instruction? Or
no,
say you've got
at that
to
time
inquire?
There was no curative instruction to be given because we didn't know the scope of the issue with the clamp, because nobody knew at that time that the clamp was in the room the day before.
The but courtroom again, deputy said, told you all at the time.
Yeah, but that was day three. The clamp was in the jury deliberation room on day two. We didn't find that out until
that. Why was all this conversation going on with the jury? I mean, I've never heard of a case where the judge is being told repeatedly what the jurors' breakdown on their votes is. Didn't the judge instruct the jury never to tell anyone what their
But the deputy clerk found out about that, and so everybody knew that the split was 9-1.
So the clerk's in there talking to the jury?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know how he knew it was 9-1, but he disclosed that to us, that it was 9-1. So we all knew it was.
So when did you find out there was a clamp in the room?
We found out
that before the verdict, right?
Yes, before the verdict, but it was on day three of the deliberations.
Right.
But we had found out after the verdict that the clamp was actually in the jury room on day two of the deliberations.
Whether you knew it was there on day three or day two, what difference does that make? Whether or not you would have said to the district court, we better make an inquiry here.
Well, because clearly it was on the jury's mind a day later. So they were thinking about it, not on the day that it was actually in the room on day two, but they were thinking about it still on day three. So that's a problem.
Any final thought? Time's about to run out.
No, Your Honor, I did. I think I made the argument I wanted to make that the laundry list of the more items that ARMS argued were trade secrets, they never introduced any evidence of those at trial. And remember, the judge set the ground rules by saying, I'm looking for the more, I'm not looking for the clamp. So therefore, the only thing that was the inquiry was on the more, and they were not trade secrets.
We have your point. Thank both counsel for their argument. Case.